Good morning and welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lennox, and Stockbridge, watching us on the PCTV Select app and on cable channel 1301. I'm Sean Sear, here with you, a special program this morning where we have Congressman Richie Neal. He is the U.S. Congressman for the 1st District in Massachusetts, and he joins us now by Zoom. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
John, how are you?
Good, thanks. And thanks for joining us here today. So much going on right now in the district and the country. So let's get right to it. I know yesterday, we're recording this this week, of course, will be playing on Friday. But this week you were up at Mass College of Liberal Arts for a big announcement about an early education center. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. And it's a terrific story at MCLA. I think this is another opportunity for them to continue to invest in workforce and in education, with the outcome obviously being a desirable one, and that is plugging people into work opportunities going forward. So it was a $1.2 million earmark that I sponsored, and it was based upon a partnership with the YMCA and early childhood education, understanding the role that early childhood education coupled with a nice academic setting would present for students who are in need of this. We have people all of the time that are reassessing their lives. Maybe it's a skills upgrade, or maybe it's just an early job. But the whole understanding and notion is that for sure that we want to make sure that child care and early childhood education is a part of it. There are right now across America about 7 million jobs that are available. Now, there is a skill set question, there's geography, there's a lot of other dimensions to that suggestion, but it's also an understanding that getting people into the workforce is really important. And I think that what we announced yesterday at MCLA with President Burge was a really significant step, along with the mayor, in the right direction.
And this was, I think they called it congressionally discretion funding or directed funding. Tell us how that works.
Well, it's actually an opportunity to reassert the congressional role in expenditure. Mm. And the Constitution is quite clear on who controls the purse strings, and it's the Congress of the United States. So members of Congress tend to know a lot more about what community needs are, with an also basic understanding. And that understanding is that the requests for this sort of spending overwhelmingly come from colleges and universities, local government. Mm-hmm. This is not as though that the private sector is being enriched. This is about a long-term investment in the educational or health care of a particular community. The hospitals benefit from this as well. Mm-hmm. But the understanding, as you know, we reopened North Adams Hospital. That was a big deal. And Again, it's this notion that congressional spending should be in some measure determined upon the priorities that members of Congress receive and then set.
And certainly with this administration, things have been sort of turned on their head in a lot of ways in terms of how funding is done and whether the executive branch has the ability of spending or changing the way that Congress has decided to spend things. That's been, I'm sure, a very difficult thing for members of Congress to sort of grapple with over the last couple of years.
Well, one of the interesting things that you've noted, and it's really on target, and that is that we are now on the eve of celebrating America's 250th anniversary with this remarkable document called the Declaration of Independence. And that declaration, written by Thomas Jefferson when he was 33 years old, was a challenge to the whole notion of the executive. And Jefferson was motivated, as many of us still to this day would be, of the Magna Carta. 1215 at Runnymede, that's when the king had to give up some of his authority to be overseen by, at that time, it would have been considered nobles. But the notion that we have in our constitutional galaxy is that there's a role for Congress to oversee the executive. And our job is not to be subservient to this president or any other president. Our job is to challenge them. And as you would recall, the other part of this amazing achievement we've had, it's the subsequent notion of a constitution. And in the constitution, Madison argued that Congress should be stronger than the executive. They were very concerned about putting too much authority in the hands of a king. And that's what this whole notion of the rebellion was about.
Yeah, in fact, I think they were very concerned about a tyrant being able to control the purse strings, right? And that's why they put the power of the purse in the legislative hands.
That's exactly the prescription. And I think that that's one of the woeful parts of the current discussion that we're witnessing, and that is that if you give up your authority, this president or other presidents will always ask for more. And I remind people, Sean, wherever I have a chance to go, that members of Congress don't serve under a president of the United States. You serve with a president of the United States.
How much damage do you think has been done to our democracy under this administration? And
Well,
will we be able to repair it? How long will it take to repair?
I remind people that it's important for us to invest in our institutions, not in our personalities. And our job in Congress and our job in elected office is not to entertain the American people. It's to inform them. And as you inform them, then you consider that they're going to make the right judgment every 2 years or every 6 years or every 4 years. And I think that that at the moment is not being acknowledged, that you're supposed to oversee. That's not to get in the way, it's to oversee, requiring reasonable explanations as to requests that come from the executive.
Are you confident that this year's midterm elections will go off efficiently and effectively without any big problems? I think there are a lot of people in the country worried maybe that our election system has been degraded a bit over the last few years.
Well, it's degraded when you have people who lost the election saying they won the election, not based upon any evidence whatsoever. I mean, we would acknowledge that Trump won in 2016 and he won in 2024. He needs to acknowledge that in 2020, he lost by 7 million votes. And the evidence that is piled up during these intervening years is so compelling and so overwhelming that I don't know why the president continues to stick to that posture, but that should not make its way into the midterm election cycle.
And you're confident you think that the states will be able to manage those elections without any interference from the federal government?
I am, and that's another important consideration as you've raised it, and that is that states are in charge of elections. They oversee elections for good reason. They get the dates for state elections. We all subscribe to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. For federal elections, that's a stated proposition. Everybody buys into that. But there are also overseers as it relates to state elections called the secretaries of state.
Right. Good reminder to let people know that that is another check and balance, right, that we have in this country, that the states operate the elections and the states have a significant amount of power when it comes to their checks and balances.
For good reason.
Congressman Richie Neal is on my program this morning, Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM. If you're just joining us, he's a U.S. Congressman for the 1st District here in Massachusetts. Also, a ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee in Congress. And I guess I have a question for you about that. Depending on the outcome of this year's election, you could be poised to take over as the chair of that committee. Once again, you have any thoughts on types of things you'd like to accomplish should you regain that committee in the next term?
Well, first of all, Sean, that's the plan. I'm very proud of what we did when I was chairman. If you look at the rescue package, which everybody got paid during the pandemic, when you look at how we expanded the child credit, when we did leave for parents, and we made sure that there was cash flow for people at the lower end of the economic spectrum, using Medicaid records to get that money out the door, what we did with the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS and Science Act, the Butch Lewis Act, SECURE. What we did with the WEP issue. And a lot of your viewers and listeners benefited from what we did with the WEP issue. We were able to draw some justification for investments that people had made in the Social Security retirement system. And all of these things happened while I was the chairman of the committee. And I call attention to that because the other endeavor that I would like to see us begin to take up is the whole issue of long-term care. And I also intend, if we win in November, to push back hard against the proposed hospital cuts that have taken place. They do not kick in until after the November election, but this would be a huge step backwards for Berkshire Health Systems, North Adams Hospital, for Fairview, for all of these hospitals that so importantly serve the people of Berkshire County. And I think that that would be part of our agenda going forward.
How do you feel the strength and the long-term stability of programs like Social Security and Medicare? We hear a lot about how Social Security could be running short of funds by 2031, which seemed like a long time away, and now it's only 5 years away. Is that something also that needs to be addressed in the coming years?
People always fix Social Security, Sean. It's very popular. People depend upon it. I always refer to Social Security as part of the three-legged stool. You have pension, you have some personal savings, and then you have the bedrock guarantee of Social Security. You know when that check is coming, you know what you're going to get, and you build around it. I think that's an essential consideration. And I also, we are in the background discussing potential solutions. When I hear people say that Social Security goes broke in 5 years, that is simply not true. It still pays, if we were to do nothing, it would still pay about 77 cents on the dollar. That is unlikely to occur because we will do something. And it's similar to what Reagan and O'Neill faced in the early 80s, and they were able to fix it. So long-term solvency is really important. And you're also a reminder of there are an enormous number of people who depend solely upon Social Security in their retirement years.
Right, those are folks that don't have those other two legs working for them, right?
They're only getting on average, this is going to be a pretty stunning number. The average Social Security benefit is about $24,000 a year. That's less than $500 a week.
Right. Very hard to live on that
It is very
these
hard.
days, especially with housing and all the costs going up. I can't imagine having that as my only source of income, but that is a reality for many people.
For sure.
Let's also talk about some of the other things that our current president wants to spend money on, since we're talking about how there are certain There are programs that really we could use, but it seems like we're concentrating on things like a ballroom, a Lincoln reflecting pool, a triumphal arch, perhaps, a UFC fight on the lawn of the White House. Are any of these things moving forward what America wants?
Well, the president announced with the ballroom, by the way, he did it in an arbitrary fashion by pulling in the bulldozers to take down part of the White House. And then he announced that it was going to be privately paid for. Well, now we know it is not going to be privately paid for. His Board of Peace was going to be privately paid for. We now know that that is not going to happen. And then there was the consideration of the $1.8 billion fund that would be utilized to pay off those who had assaulted police officers and maimed a couple of them on January 6th.
Were you at the Capitol on
I was
January
in the
6th?
Capitol that day, carefully chronicled my memories of it, and I was in the hallway as they came through. My office at the time, because of being the chairman of the committee, was right in the Capitol, and the door was pounded on. The police were in the office with me. We had a massive table that we put against the door to keep them out. The door was bowing, and those police served us with great valor that day. And instead, the president said that this initiative that he's come up has come up with, this would mean that the chief law enforcement agent in the country, the president, would allocate money to those who assaulted the Capitol, those who have always been found guilty in court. And then he decided that he would pardon all of them, and now he wants to pay them off for bad behavior. So
There's a good amount of self-dealing there, it seems like.
it is self-dealing.
Doing yourself and then paying yourself off.
Well, you've got to admit this, though. It's a clever notion when you can be the plaintiff and the defendant in your own law case.
Does this have any chance of getting paid out? I hear now that he may be abandoning the idea of it, but it's not a dead issue yet, right? Does this
No,
have a chance of getting through?
we intend to make it a dead issue, I can tell you that. If we could force a vote on the floor, which we will try hard to do, and I assume we can, we will cancel this project of his, the $1.8 billion. I never, in my worst dreams, would have come up with something like this.
Do you need a significant amount of help from your Republican colleagues to step forward and do the right thing on this? How forthcoming is that
A
right
significant
now?
number anymore. You need about five, and that would take care of it. That's my guess is that I could already predict the districts where they would abandon the president on this.
Congressman Richie Neal, guest here on Morning Drive this morning on WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7. Some of this harkens back to me, and you probably have some thoughts about the echoes of history from the end of the Watergate era when Congress had to pass some pretty significant legislation to address some of the wrongs that happened during the Watergate era. I think of the War Powers Act, for example. What kinds of repairs will we need going forward after this? And I think about first thing I think about is pardon reform, because you just mentioned pardoning all the people that assaulted police officers during January 6th, and that is, of course, a something that's in the Constitution that the president has the sole power to pardon. But should there be some sort of review of that or some look at that for a
Sure.
constitutional amendment?
You have prosecutors, you have federal judges, you have the defense bar. They've all questioned this. And now there seems to be some evidence that if you hire the right advocate, you might be able to secure a pardon. And I think that there needs to be more sunlight as it relates to how that determination, decision making has come about. I think even in Colorado, where the president pressured the governor of Colorado to pardon the former Secretary of State, who knowingly and willfully embraced and implemented the theory that somehow the Colorado election had been forfeited. And I look at what's happened with these pardons that the president puts out. It seems as though it's based on the mood of the day for him, who he likes, who he dislikes. And I think that's a worrisome trend in our democracy.
It doesn't seem like something that the founding fathers had envisioned could potentially happen, right? That you could have that kind of abuse of a constitutional power.
Well, this is even after people who have been found guilty in front of a court of just their peers, as our Constitution prescribes. And some of these cases are pretty bad. I mean, you look at some of the Medicare fraud, it's pretty wild as to who's been pardoned. And again, you look at the fact that all of those individuals who assaulted and attacked the Capitol of the United States, they were all pardoned. And the president calls it the weaponization of the federal government. It's called justice, and they should not be pardoned.
Fair enough. I would like to see how that all pans out. It's going to be a process that, like you said, is not a dead issue just yet. I want to return a little bit back to the district here for a moment and just ask you, what do you think is the number one concern right now of your constituents in the district? And if you can't just limit it to one, give us your top three. What are people most thinking about? What's on their mind? What are they concerned about moving forward?
Prices.
Prices, number
That is a
one.
big issue. Gasoline is up by $1.59 a gallon. The war in the Strait of Hormuz with Iran appears to be stalemated at the moment. And by the way, when you say that it's stalemated, you're not cheering for the other side. The president said this would be done in 4 or 5 weeks. Well, we're into the fourth month. And he has announced six times that the war is over, only to revisit it sometimes that night or sometimes that afternoon, that he's going to resume the bombing campaign. The truth is that he was warned by General Kane, his top military advisor, that securing and keeping the Strait of Hormuz open would be a very hard thing to do. And I think if you look at what's happened right now in the Strait of Hormuz, 20% of the world's oil and gas travels through the Strait of Hormuz. And the outcome is clearly the cost of living. And people are feeling it everywhere. I mean, gasoline, I think for the average family, it's going to be about $1,000 a year that they would use on other services. And when you look at what's happened in that instance to a minimum wage employee, that means that they go to work one day a week just to fill their gas tank in some parts of the country. So I think prices. That's the big issue. And I think that the corresponding part of the price issue is inflation and
So it's really the volatility and the instability of those prices too, right? If people can predict how much they have to pay, they've got their housing, which of course is already expensive, and then now you add on an extra cost of gas or maybe insurance or other things that they weren't expecting to go up quite as much. And now you have a real crisis.
Well, the price of housing has gone up substantially, and the difficulty is so has the borrowing rates. Sometimes those move in different directions, not in this case. I think that you're looking at, I think over the weekend, we were back to a little bit north of 6% on a 30-year mortgage, and housing prices in many places have just gone through the roof. So I think that that has created the volatility in the housing market, which, as you know, is still a major part of the American dream.
Right. And along those lines, I wanted to ask you about something that we hear about occasionally, something called the K-shaped economy. I'm
Yes.
sure you're familiar with this term, right? So that things seem to be going, we hear about the economy doing fine, people have jobs, the stock market is over 50,000, right? The typical thing that we hear. And yet, people, everyday people, are struggling to get by. So it seems like the best of the economy is being driven by the people with the most, and the
For
people
sure.
with the least are wondering, where did the train go? The train left without me. I didn't get any of this benefit.
Well, I raised that very issue a couple of days ago at MCLA, and we were talking about what is known as labor participation rates. So the labor participation rate right now has risen by about 0.8% in the last year. And that oftentimes is a pretty good indicator of where the economy is. And all that means is who would be eligible to go to work is actually working. And that's something to always keep an eye on because right now, even though the unemployment rate is at about 4.3%, then what that really means is that it might be at 4.3%, but if you're still spending more based on the same pay for all of the items that we would call discretionary spending, you're trying to batten down all of the outcomes.
Yeah, and I think the discretionary part of people's budgets is evaporating, right? They have to spend so much on housing, they have to spend so much on transportation, especially out here in the first district where we don't have the level of public transportation, let's say, that other parts of the state have. It makes it very difficult to do those extra things that we're sort of used to doing.
Well, if you're working on a certain income and you're going to get a 3% increase in pay, that was the average last year across the country. But if that's eaten up immediately by gasoline and food costs and maybe more, there's no advance. So that's when you begin to cut back on other discretionary expenditure. I heard an interesting story yesterday that when I was in the Berkshires, I was talking to an individual who said to me that he thought that lottery sales would be down because of this. That's a place where people cut back. That for sure. It's a vivid example of what happens with discretionary spending. So you're not buying that $2 lottery ticket anymore.
Yeah, that makes a big difference. And so, we're all looking to look for solutions and resolutions to these things that people have in their daily lives. And certainly the gas prices, when people drive by the gas stations every day, it's a constant reminder, right, of why that happened. And perhaps that is something that will impact the decisions of the midterm elections. Do you feel like the war in Iran was just a war of choice? Was it an ill-advised war that really isn't going to produce any of the outcomes that the president was hoping for? Is that where you see it?
It was a war of choice for sure. Coupled with the following fact that the president seems to always look for what he perceives to be the quick win. And then you find out that that's not the case any longer. Example, when he ran for president, he said he would end the war between Ukraine and Russia on day one. That was 5 years ago. He said that he would end the war in Gaza. That was a year ago. And he said we would be in and out of the Strait of Hormuz in 4 to 5 weeks. That was 3.5 months ago. And I call attention to that because he tends to lose interest, it seems, when things don't go his way. And when you look at the evidence, he has been advised that these things would not go his way. And the valiant effort of the Ukrainian people to stand up to Putin and his war machine now looks as though it could succeed. I mean, it's when you look at what Zelensky has said, done, and promised, it's pretty impressive. They essentially have fought Russia to a standstill. And the European Union, NATO, they're the ones that have taken up and tried to fill the vacuum that was created by the lack of American involvement. We have pulled back from our long-term allies. The president, by alienating Canada and Mexico, NATO, European Union, again, it contributes to the chaos of the decision making, and it makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to plan around it. But NATO has proved itself time and again to be durable. It succeeded. The collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the yoke of Marxism having been lifted from the necks of the people of Eastern Europe. All of these considerations were based upon America keeping its word. And every president since Truman, Democrat and or Republican, all until this moment, have been steadfast in their support of NATO.
So, what do you see as a likely outcome then for the outcome of this Iran war? I mean, it doesn't seem like there are any good outcomes for the United States other than potentially making us putting us in a weaker position. Well, how do we get out of it, and what ends up being the benefit?
Well, there's going to be a negotiated settlement. I think it's going to be multilateral. I think that clearly we're going to need some support from our allies in the region. As you know, there's some suspicion as it relates to whether it's Saudi Arabia or Egypt and others. They're keeping a careful eye on this as to whether or not America has kept its word. And I think that we're going to need them in a settlement. Nobody is cheering for the Ayatollah, let me assure you of that. I think we're all glad that the former Ayatollah is gone. But it's also a reminder that he is likely to have been replaced by somebody who's even more radical in their views. And I always look at it this way. Whenever you were playing on a sports team, one of the worst things that could happen is you'd be playing an inferior team, and the inferior team starts to think they can win. It changes the whole dynamic of the game. So I think here we still want an outcome where America prevails for sure. And by the way, the military has done exactly what was asked of them. Exactly what was asked of them. But I think, again, the chaotic nature of the president changing his mind every hour has not been helpful.
It seems like the initial strategy was faulty, right? Because every president up until this point has never wanted to engage Iran in that kind of war because they knew the choke point was the Strait of Hormuz, and that Iran would do everything it could to shut that down and create pain for the world economy. And I feel like that's maybe where we are right now.
Well, I always think there's a danger of presidents overpromising in these instances. I'm one of the few people who voted against the war in Iraq. I just didn't believe what was being told to me. And here we are, 20 years plus later, and there is still the argument as to how to pay for parts of the war in Iraq. These are long-term consequences.
And these are things I think people also voted for to not get us entangled in another forever war, right? I think that
I'm
was
being
one of the
hard on.
mandates that,
Criticize traditional Republican thinking. As you know, there's some pushback against him on that basis in Congress, not as much as I thought there would be. But he now, in this last 24, 48 hours, as we speak, he seems to have adopted almost an indifference, like saying, well, just trust me, this will be fine in the next few weeks. He doesn't know that, and we don't know that.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
You're tuned to Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield and 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu.
And from Sandrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Massachusetts. Retractable awnings, retractable screen, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sandrini.com.
PCTV Select is a great way to watch local content without having a cable subscription. You can keep up with the latest of what's going on in your community from anywhere in the world. And it's available for free right now. Watch live events in full HD on your TV, on your computer, or on the go with your mobile device. Or watch our large library of on-demand video programs anytime that's convenient for you. No more waiting until it's on TV. Did we mention it's free? PCTV Select is everywhere you need to be.
It feels like nobody can agree on anything anymore. But disagreements lead to compromise, and compromise leads to progress. And that's the way we accomplish important things in a democracy. Luckily, we have PCTV's coverage of our local meetings, and we can see for ourselves the issues that are in front of us. We can watch our elected officials decide how to solve problems, and that service must have support to survive. Because if there's one thing we can agree on, it's PCTV's reliable coverage. PCTV, support transparency.
Hey, this is Mike Pezzo. Remember those tunes your parents told you to turn down? Better yet, remember those tunes your grandparents told your parents to turn down? Well, on Mike's Amazing Music and Oldies show, you'll hear sometimes oldies, sometimes blues, sometimes local performers, and a lot of rock on Berkshire County's only rock station, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, Thursdays at noon. Tune in and be entertained and educated.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts, the Northern Berkshire Early Intervention Program is now accepting applications for an occupational therapist to support child development, empower families, and change futures. 2026 graduates welcome to apply. Apply today at ucpwma.org.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the morning drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Congressman Richie Neal is my guest here this morning on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, WSBR 88.1 in Lee, Lenox, and Stockbridge. Let's talk about the internment camps and Homeland Security and the disturbing visuals that we've been seeing, certainly recently in New Jersey, where protesters were outside and were pepper gassed and basically demonstrating their First Amendment rights to demonstrate peacefully. This is something that's been repeated across the country in different places. We saw, of course, what happened in Minneapolis in January, what happened in Chicago, what happened in Los Angeles. This is a disturbing trend, isn't it, for our democracy?
It sure is, because when the president said that he was going to tackle the issue of immigration, they advertised that as being, they were going to take on the worst of the worst. That is not what has happened. You have individuals here who, in some instances, are just regularizing their status, who have been apprehended and then sent back to countries that they're not even from. This can be done in a far more humane manner. Nobody's cheering for a felonious behavior. Mm-hmm. What I think we are saying is, what about a humanitarian undertaking? And I know Mikey Sherrill, the governor of New Jersey, very well. She was in the House with us for a period of time. You're not going to find anybody more reasonable than she is. And I think that what ICE has done is to overdo what they said they were going to undertake. And the result has been the chaos that we're seeing in many of these big cities. So you have people that are being held whose status is in doubt, but not necessarily illegal. And I think that there's very little room in this administration from Miller on down as to how that should be handled.
It seems also like the conditions in these internment camps, the presence of them alone, I think, should be shuddering to people and calling back to the days of the Japanese internment camps during World War II. So it's just disgraceful, I think.
Now you're finding out that people who go to courthouses and go to other federal agencies to regularize their green card status are being told they've got to go back to the country that they were from, even though that's a very important part of the American experience and economy. That was Republicans and Democrats used to agree on that. And now this president says to have your green card updated, you have to return to the original country that you immigrated from.
But I think, you know, the conditions of these locations is the very difficult thing that everybody needs to open their eyes to, right? And that the administration is also trying to build many more of these throughout the country. They're facing pushback from citizens all around the country. I don't know if we've had so much of that here in Massachusetts. I know there was a proposal to build one just order in New Hampshire over the winter that looks like it has failed. How can Congress push back against that and sort of join the ranks of other people to say, we don't want that in this country?
ICE needs to be restrained and reformed. They have a valid role to play at the border. But what's happening is that they're being asked to replace police departments who are trained in crowd control. Local police departments, they know how to restrain themselves and to maintain order during a tumultuous period of time. ICE is not trained for that. And I think that's part of what we're witnessing and experiencing. And it's painful.
And so will we see that kind of restoration going forward?
If we win in November, that will be a priority.
Congressman Richie Neal is my guest here. We've only got a few minutes left of our interview this morning on Morning Drive. So many questions to ask, so little. What kind of plans do you have should you take reclaim the chairmanship of the Ways and Means? Will it involve anything to do with the IRS? Will it involve anything to do with records that were given over from Social Security or mass deportation, things like that? Are those things that your committee can take on depending on what happens in the election?
We oversee the IRS, so you can be sure that those documents and that information that was leaked, that will be near the top of the agenda. When you look at DOGE, what they did to cut the employee base, 25,000 employees eliminated from the IRS, 25,000 employees eliminated from Social Security, and now you're seeing that there was no evidence to get rid of these employees.
What was the theory to eliminate them in the first place, do you think?
Well, I think it was to satisfy a number.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the idea that you have a 23-year-old kid with no experience whatsoever sending out these announcements that these projects were no longer going to be honored, that employees would leak information from Social Security files, which is protected information with the understanding that privacy is next to liberty in a democracy. If you have a loved one who is disabled and they're receiving a Social Security benefit, that information is privately held and supposed to be protected rather than sharing that as they've done. And over the weekend, there was that story about the DOGE employee who, by the way, had no idea what he was doing, but he's looking for private contracts while he's hatcheting employees at Social Security. And a couple of these cases, they're so outrageous. And here's the payoff, that for all the talk in a budget north of $4 trillion, their understanding is that they eliminated $1 billion. And that's even under challenge.
Hmm. So the target was much more than $1 billion, right? Supposedly.
Well, they were up to $1 trillion they were going to save. And when you look at the evidence of what was done, DOGE doesn't really even exist anymore because they were so embarrassed by what they did not accomplish.
And I think you mentioned the privacy issue too, and everyone knows how important it is to keep your social security records and your, yes. you know, the things that you have to make sure that those don't get out there and don't get hacked. And yet here's the federal government sort of leaking them, getting them, who knows, you know, did it go to Palantir and to Peter Thiel somehow, or Elon Musk? Does he have those records now?
Well, if you recall, one of the things that they did, they had some 19-year-old kid who was a college student going through the records. So I've been knowledgeable about the case that is going to continue to come forward. I have met with the plaintiff in that case. I have met with the IRS commissioner in that place, and we intend to get to the bottom of exactly how that data was released to do harm to reputation.
And Congressman Neal, how do you feel about the recent efforts of gerrymandering throughout various different states to sort of, it's basically election engineering in a way. It started with Texas at the direction of the president to try and gain back some seats, mainly, I think, to try and tip the scales a bit for the election for this coming year. And then the Democrats in various states tried to counter, California and Virginia and other places like that. And I don't know where it ends up, but in general, how do you feel about this gerrymandering? Should there be some sort of national law or rule about this so that we're all working on an even playing field?
The process right now is ill-considered. The Supreme Court did not help matters. If they were going to okay some of these new congressional districts, they could have held that announcement until after the filing deadlines. So they conceivably, if they disagreed over the Voting Rights Act, which I think they made a horrific mistake on, what they could have done was to say that these new lines will kick in 2028, giving people an opportunity to absorb or to digest the information. Here's the downside, that if this is going to happen now every 2 years, members of Congress are unlikely to know what districts they're running in. And I think that requiring our Constitution to play out is the obligation. Constitution says that we shall enumerate the number of people living in the country once every 10 years.
Right.
That's the law.
That's the census.
And
usually the redistricting happens a couple of years after that.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Count people, and then every district is supposed to have roughly the same number of people. A quick example that I would share is that I think when Silvio Conti was the member of Congress from the Berkshires, his district had about 400,000 people. Today, my district includes the Berkshires, and it has about 757,000 people.
Wow.
So that's the sort of change that comes about. But anybody who thinks that the two political parties are going to disarm based upon the Supreme Court ruling, not so. I can already predict where Democratic majorities will go next year. And I don't think it's helpful to democracy.
Mm. And of course, if you have a Democratic and a Republican Senate, if that's the way it comes down, we could be looking at another 2 years of gridlock where really nothing gets done or very close to nothing.
That's a possibility. But I intend to tell you that we're going to make a charge to get some things done.
All right, Congressman Richie Neal, just last question here as we're wrapping up our interview on Morning Drive, and we thank you again for being here with us. Are you looking forward to getting a $250 bill to put in your wallet that has President Trump's face on it?
I'm looking forward to stopping it.
Is there a way to stop it? Because it is illegal, right, to have a living person's picture on currency?
You need congressional approval coupled with the fact that the Secretary of the Treasury, he comes under the jurisdiction of the Ways and Means Committee.
And hence, we're back around to what we were talking about before, right? So maybe we won't see that $250 bill. Just to remind people that they can't afford to put a $250 bill in their wallet.
That's right.
All right. Congressman Richie Neal from the 1st Congressional District here in Massachusetts, we thank you for your time today, and thank you for joining Morning Drive. Look forward to having you back on the show sometime in the future.
Thanks, Sean. Happy to do it.
All right. Thank you.